Welcome back. This half hour of the show brought to you by NIL Game Changers, the ultimate destination for name, image, and likeness opportunities for both athletes and businesses. Visit NILGameChangers.org to start your journey. And the Pirates have started their journey, and John Parato has all these great connections to the Valley, now joins us. He covers the Pirates. John, great to have you with us.
Yeah, so they both passed away, but both my sisters-in-laws and their family lived there, and my wife grew up in Sunbury.
Right, so in other words, our ratings have doubled today just by having you on.
Oh, at least. I'm very big in Sunbury, Steve. Huge.
Not really. No surprise to this veteran campaigner. All right. So, John, what I found interesting, and I know Shelton addressed this yesterday a bit, there's been really very little drama with some of the late roster moves over the years. Like sometimes going into opening day, they've had some dramas who's going to be there. What does that tell us about the lack of drama with this roster coming out of camp?
I think it's a good sign. I think that it was, you know, a good spring, and I think it shows that they have more stability now than they've had in a few years, where in many other years you went to spring training and there were three, four roster spots, or not spots, I should say, jobs in the lineup that were up in the air. And I think this shows they have some stability now. They have some direction, and it's no longer trying to overhaul the roster every year. It is now to more fine-tune things than just have basically an open tryout camp for 6 weeks.
All right. Now, let's get to the actual roster itself. What guys, look, spring training's different. Like, you can sit there and go hit 400 in spring training, and you're 0 for 4 in opening day. Your batting average is 0. Okay. So, but who really had the look in training camp that you liked?
Well, I thought the most encouraging sign, Steve, was O'Neill Cruz, the shortstop, who basically missed the entire season, got hurt in the second weekend of the season last year, broke his ankle, and missed the rest of the year. He hit 7 home runs, and more importantly, he was moving around well. He wasn't playing with a limp. He seemed to have his speed intact after that broken ankle. But, I mean, this is a guy who clearly has big-time power at 6'7", and, you know, for him to hit 7 home runs, and not only that, but he cut down on his strikeouts. He, you know, I wasn't there the entire spring, but the times I saw him play, he didn't chase it nearly as many bad pitches. And I know talking to Shelton and talking to Andy Haynes, the hitting coach, they also were pleased by how much he has gotten better as being able to lay off the bad pitches. And if he does that, then I really think the sky's the limit, because the only thing holding him back was just the strikeouts, and so many times he got himself out by not swinging at good pitches.
Henry Davis, they really felt like they needed his bat, because his bat had a major league look to it, but they had to play him in the field, especially in right field. He's been behind the plate, and by all signs, John, it appears he has improved back there. What impressed you about his work behind the plate? Because I think the bat's a given.
Well, I think what impressed me most, Steve, is he basically took no off season at all, except for a week between Christmas and New Year's, talking with him. You know, most of the winter he spent in Bradenton at the Pirate City training facility there, worked on his defense, which was really the big question mark, was if he was going to be good enough to stay behind the plate. Also went to Driveline Institute in Seattle, which is a lot of players go to now. They have a lot of computer-based analysis, analytical-type analysis that help players improve. And he really improved his defense. And I know they signed Yasmani Grandal, the veteran catcher, and I think they thought he would be the number one and Davis would either be the number two or go to Indianapolis at AAA for more seasoning. But Davis really seized the job, and I think even though Grandal did get hurt and will begin the year on the injured list, I think Henry Davis would have been the number one catcher regardless. And, you know, I'll give him credit. He took, he's taken a lot of heat from the fans and on social media. A lot of people thought he was a bust because he was the first overall pick in the 2021 draft out of Louisville. but he worked really, really, really hard, and he really deserves the chance to be the starting catcher after all the work he put in and all the improvement he showed.
Do the fans on social media know this is baseball and this isn't the NFL? The first overall pick still takes a couple of years to get there? Do they understand that? I mean, this isn't the NBA, man.
I don't think a lot of them do, unfortunately. I think when you're here in Pittsburgh, it's a football mentality, and everybody wants, like, every game is the most important game of the year, and if you lose a game, it's like you're never going to win another game. And I think that's the mentality that happens sometimes.
Yeah,
I mean, then you put it on social media, Steve, and it amplifies by about 15.
Exactly. Look, there's some great social media that's being used out there, and then there are others where you know it's not a Mensa convention. All right, so defensively, I thought the Pirates were a little bit better defensively last year. Did you see a better defensive team in Florida?
Yeah, I did. You know, I think, I don't think they're going to have gold glovers every position, but they do have to keep Brian Hayes at third, who won a gold glove. Jared Triolo is making the transition from third, where he was never going to play because of Hayes, over to second base, and he looked very good at second base. I think O'Neill Cruz looked solid at shortstop. The outfield defense looked good in the games I saw, and I don't know if it's going to be like one of the top five in major league defenses, but I certainly think it's a lot better than it was 2 years ago, and I think it'll be better than it was last year too.
How do you view the rotation? I mean, the contract for Keller and so forth, but how do you view the rotation? Then I'll get to Bednar in a moment.
Well, it's no question it's a little bit iffy. And, I mean, it could be good if some things work out right, and it could be a real problem if things don't. Mitch Keller, as you alluded to, he's going to be the opening day starter on Thursday in Miami. It'll be his second straight year. He signed a five-year, $77 million contract early in spring training. Then they have a couple of veteran lefties in Martin Perez and Marco Gonzalez, who they signed Perez and traded for Gonzalez in the offseason. Both of them had down years last year, but Perez was really, really sharp this spring. Gonzalez was so-so, but Gonzalez, they both have track records of being pretty good big league pitchers. And then the fourth and fifth spot, it's interesting, Bailey Falter, the former Philly left-hander who they picked up in a trade last July, kind of surprisingly is going to be the fourth starter. He didn't necessarily have a great spring, but they saw enough in him, and he also was out of minor league options, so they would have had to put him through waivers if they tried to send him to the minor leagues. He's at least going to start the year off in the rotation. And then one of the great stories of spring training for the Pirates, Jared Jones, one of their very top prospects, a 22-year-old right-hander. He went the whole spring without giving up an earned run in 16 and a third innings, and he made the team. They told him yesterday he's on the team. He started last year in Altoona at Double-A, finished at the Triple-A in Indianapolis, had a pretty good year, but he was really, really good this spring, and I saw him pitch a couple times when I was down there, and they feel he's ready at 22, and it's exciting to see what he can do. He was their second-round pick in 2020, and he clearly has a great arm. He throws hard, he has a good slider, and the times I talked to him, he doesn't seem intimidated at all. He seems like, from a mental standpoint, that he feels like he's ready to face big league hitters and he's confident he can get them out.
Yeah, that's something, I guess his reaction was priceless when they told him yesterday. You know, it's like one of those rewarding things for any manager to get that kind of reaction out of somebody that made the club. Now Bednar, he is going to stay in Bradenton for a little bit. So where is he right now on the path back?
Well, they don't seem concerned. He missed a lot of the spring. He had the tightness in his lat muscle behind his right shoulder. But he only pitched twice this spring. He pitched last Thursday. It was the first time he pitched in a game situation all spring. I'm a little worried myself. I mean, the guy only logged two innings the entire Grapefruit League season. I don't know how ready he'll be. Like you said, they held him back He's going to pitch in an inter squad minor league type situation, and then they hope to have him Thursday in Miami for the opener. But I'm just a touch concerned. You know, one of the great things that's helped them is he stayed healthy for the 3 years he's been there, and he's turned into one of the best relief pitchers in the major leagues. But there's never really been a health issue outside of a back issue 2 years ago. But as far as an arm problem, he's never had any arm problems. And this is technically not an arm problem, but it is behind his shoulder. And I don't have a lot of confidence in somebody going into the season and only pitched twice all spring. But hopefully I'm wrong. And he'll be okay, but I do think there's cause for a little bit of a red flag there, Steve.
So, John, who closes then until he gets back?
Well, Aroldis Chapman would be most likely the former Reds and Yankees closer, and I know that the Pirates surprised a lot of people in the winter when they signed Chapman as a free agent for 1 year and $10.5 million, which is a lot of money by Pirates standards. And, you know, he has over 300 career saves. He's been a six- or seven-time All-Star. And it looks to me, what I saw him in spring training and, you know, with scouts and other people that saw him other times when I wasn't there, is he still throws close to 100, and he's still an effective pitcher. And they feel, the Pirates do, and the scouts I talked to all feel if something would happen to Bednar, that Chapman could still come back, you know, still step into that closer's role and be a very effective pitcher.
Yeah, he can be. He also is the kind of guy that creates managers to find religion. All right, so he does all of that and more. How important, now, I know the club got off to a good start last year. How important is it going to be for this club to just get out of the gate, get off to a start, maybe build something early?
Yeah, I think the one thing that they did build some momentum last year, and they had the great start, and then they weren't very good for 2.5 months, and then they finished strong. They went 18-13. They basically knocked the Reds and the Cubs out of pennant contention in the last 2 weeks of the season. So, I mean, you'd like to build on that. I don't think they're going to get out of the gate 22-8 like they did last year, but. You know, I think there's optimism there. There's a feeling that there's finally some light at the end of the tunnel in this long rebuilding that they've been under since Ben Cherington became GM after the 2019 season. And I think they need to play good baseball. I don't think they need to be 22-8. But the worst thing that would happen when you finally build optimism, both inside your clubhouse, inside your organization, and with the fans here in the Pittsburgh area, is to start off the season like 6-17 or something like that. I think if they can at least keep their heads above water, I think eventually some of the young pitching prospects will come up and stabilize that pitching staff. And I think they have a chance in a division that's really not all that strong to maybe contend if a few things break right. But I do think for the morale of everyone, they do need to get off to if not a blazing start, certainly a good start to keep that good feeling going from throughout the end of last season in the winter that things are starting to pick up here.
By the way, what is the thought process in Pittsburgh about the club, about going to the ballpark? I mean, how does the average everyday fan feel about the team?
I think they're encouraged. I think they're a little skeptical because of the owner, Bob Nutting, who historically has just not really tried to win, to be totally honest, and not spent the money necessary. But I do think they look at some of the young players here. And I think the fact that the Pirates brought Andrew McCutchen back last year was definitely a very good PR move. And not only that, but he can still play. He's certainly not an MVP caliber player like he was 10 years ago. Sure. But he can still play and contribute. And I think that helped a lot. And I do think there is optimism. There seems to be a lot more interest, you know, take it for what it's worth. But if I'm out, like at the bank or the supermarket or something, you know, I run into people, they'll ask me about the Pirates and seem to want to talk about them. And there for a few years, I mean, nobody gave, could care less. So I do think there is more interest here in Pittsburgh. And now it's up to the Pirates to give the fans reason to sustain that interest.
Hey, John, this is a pleasure. Really appreciate it. Great information, as always, and just appreciate the time you gave us.
Oh, my pleasure, Steve. Thanks for having me on anytime.
John Parrotto, who covers the Pittsburgh Pirates, all those great local connections. Great to have John on the show today. Bob Nightingale, by the way, next hour, we'll talk about the start of Major League Baseball, some of his storylines, and also about Shohei Ohtani. And we'll hear from Bob in the next hour. Penn State football next half hour. This half hour been brought to you by NIL Game Changers. We'll come back with more in a moment on News Radio 1070 WKOK.
You want a unique way to display your brand. You need a team of seasoned experts to work with. You want to reach customers who buy. You want NIL Game Changers, a versatile consulting agency powered by former student athletes and coaches who work as NIL sports agents. NIL Game Changers will help you build powerful relationships with customers through compelling stories, with student athlete influencers as your leading edge. Finally, we'll equip you with the right media to drive your success home. NILGameChangers.org, building meaningful relationships with your customers.
Hi, this is Season. For over 100 years, the Purdy Insurance Agency has been protecting families and businesses of the greater Susquehanna Valley and beyond. With the experience of our trained and knowledgeable staff, you can rest assured that your needs will be evaluated and met by some of the industry's best representatives. No matter what your insurance needs are, call Purdy Insurance today at 570-286-5855. Visit our website at purdyinsurance.com or check us out on Facebook to see what we can do for you.
Welcome back. This half hour of the show brought to you by NIL Game Changers, the ultimate destination for name, image, and likeness opportunities for both athletes and businesses. Visit NILGameChangers.org to start your journey. And the Pirates have started their journey, and John Parrotto has all these great connections to the Valley now joins us. He covers the Pirates. John, great to have you with us.
Yeah, so they both passed away, but both my sisters-in-laws and their family live there, and my wife grew up in Sunbury.
Right, so in other words, our ratings have doubled today just by having you on.
Oh, at least. I'm very big in Sunbury, Steve. Huge.
Not really. No surprise to this veteran campaigner. All right, so... John, what I found interesting, and I know Shelton addressed this yesterday a bit, there's been really very little drama with some of the late roster moves. Over the years, like sometimes going into opening day, they've had some drama as to who's going to be there. What does that tell us about the lack of drama with this roster coming out of camp?
I think it's a good sign. I think that it was, you know, a good spring, and I think it shows that they have more stability now than they've had in a few years, where in many other years you went to spring training and there were 3-4 roster spots, or not spots, I should say, jobs in the lineup that were up in the air. And I think this shows they have some stability now. They have some direction. And it's no longer trying to overhaul the roster every year. It is now to more fine-tune things than just have basically an open tryout camp for 6 weeks.
All right. Now, let's get to the actual roster itself. What guys – look, spring training's different. Like, you can sit there and go hit 400 in spring training, and you're 0-for-4 in opening day. Your batting average is zero. Okay. So, but who really had the look in training camp that you liked?
Well, I thought the most encouraging sign, Steve, was O'Neill Cruz, the shortstop, who basically missed the entire season, got hurt in the second weekend of the season last year, broke his ankle, and missed the rest of the year. He hit 7 home runs, and more importantly, he was moving around well. He wasn't playing with a limp. He seemed to have his speed intact after that broken ankle. But, I mean, this is a guy who clearly has big, big, big-time power at 6'7", and, you know, for him to hit 7 home runs, and not only that, but he cut down on his strikeouts. He, you know, I wasn't there the entire spring, but the times I saw him play, he didn't chase it nearly as many bad pitches. And I know talking to Shelton and talking to Andy Haynes, the hitting coach, they also were pleased by how much he has gotten better as being able to lay off the bad pitches. And if he does that, then I really think the sky's the limit, because the only thing holding him back was just the strikeouts, and so many times he got himself out by not swinging at good pitches.
Henry Davis, they really felt like they needed his bat because his bat had a major league look to it, but they had to play him in the field, especially in right field. He's been behind the plate, and by all signs, John, it appears he has improved back there. What impressed you about his work behind the plate? Because I think the bat's a given.
Well, I think what impressed me most, Steve, is he basically took no off season at all, except for a week between Christmas and New Year's, talking with him. You know, most of the winter he spent in Bradenton at the Pirate City training facility there, worked on his defense, which was really the big question mark, was if he was going to be good enough to stay behind the plate. Also went to Driveline Institute in Seattle, which is a lot of players go to now. They have a lot of computer-based analysis, analytical-type analysis that help players improve. And he really improved his defense. And I know they signed Yasmani Grandal, the veteran catcher, and I think they thought he would be the number one and Davis would either be the number two or go to Indianapolis at AAA for more seasoning. But Davis really seized the job, and I think even though Grandal did get hurt and will begin the year on the injured list, I think Henry Davis would have been the number one catcher regardless. And, you know, I'll give him credit. He took, he's taken a lot of heat from the fans and on social media. A lot of people thought he was a bust because he was the first overall pick in the 2021 draft out of Louisville. But he worked really, really, really hard, and he really deserves the chance to be the starting catcher after all the work he put in and all the improvement he showed.
Do the fans on social media know this is baseball and this isn't the NFL? The first overall pick still takes a couple of years to get there. Do they understand that? I mean, this isn't the NBA, man.
I don't think a lot of them do, unfortunately. I think when you're here in Pittsburgh, it's a football mentality, and everybody wants, like, every game is the most important game of the year, and if you lose a game, it's like you're never going to win another game. And I think that's the mentality that happens sometimes.
Yeah, I mean,
then you put it on social media, Steve, and it amplifies by about 15.
Exactly. Look, there's some great social media that's being used out there, and then there are others where you know it's not a Mensa convention. All right, so defensively, I thought the Pirates were a little bit better defensively last year. Did you see a better defensive team in Florida?
Yeah, I did. You know, I think, I don't think they're going to have Gold Glovers every position, but they do have to keep Brian Hayes at third, who won a Gold Glove. Jared Triolo is making the transition from third, where he was never going to play because of Hayes, over to second base, and he looked very good at second base. I think O'Neill Cruz looked solid at shortstop. The outfield defense looked good in the games I saw, and I don't know if it's going to be one of the top five in major league defenses, but I certainly think it's a lot better than it was 2 years ago, and I think it'll be better than it was last year too.
How do you view the rotation? I mean, the contract for Keller and so forth, but how do you view the rotation? Then I'll get to Bednar in a moment.
Well, no question, it's a little bit iffy. And, I mean, it could be good if some things work out right, and it could be a real problem if things don't. Mitch Keller, as you alluded to, he's going to be the opening day starter on Thursday in Miami. It'll be his second straight year. He signed a five-year, $77 million contract early in spring training. Then they have a couple of veteran lefties in Martin Perez and Marco Gonzalez, who they signed Perez and traded for Gonzalez in the offseason. Both of them had down years last year, but Perez was really, really sharp this spring. Gonzalez was so-so, but Gonzalez, they both have track records of being pretty good big league pitchers. And then the fourth and fifth spot, it's interesting, Bailey Falter, the former Philly left-hander who they picked up in a trade last July, kind of surprisingly is going to be the fourth starter. He didn't necessarily have a great spring, but they saw enough in him, and he also was out of minor league options, so they would have had to put him through waivers if they tried to send him to the minor leagues. He's at least going to start the year off in the rotation. And then one of the great stories of spring training for the Pirates, Jared Jones, one of their very top prospects, a 22-year-old right-hander. He went the whole spring without giving up an earned run in 16 and a third innings, and he made the team. They told him yesterday he's on the team. He started last year in Altoona, Double-A, finished at Triple-A in Indianapolis, had a pretty good year, but he was really, really good this spring, and I saw him pitch a couple times when I was down there, and they feel he's ready at 22, and it's exciting to see what he can do. He was their second-round pick in 2020, and he clearly has a great arm. He throws hard, he has a good slider, and the times I talked to him, he doesn't seem intimidated at all. He seems like, from a mental standpoint, that he feels like he's ready to face big league hitters, and he's confident he can get them out.
Yeah, that's something. I guess his reaction was priceless when they told him yesterday. This is like one of those rewarding things for any manager to get that kind of reaction out of somebody that made the club. Now Bednar, he is going to stay in Bradenton for a little bit. So where is he right now on the path back?
Well, they don't seem concerned. He missed a lot of the spring. He had a tightness in his lat muscle behind his right shoulder. And he only pitched twice this spring. He pitched last Thursday. It was the first time he pitched in a game situation all spring. I'm a little worried myself. I mean, the guy only logged two innings the entire Grapefruit League season. I don't know how ready he'll be. Like you said, they held him back. He's going to pitch. He pitched. He's going to pitch in an inter squad minor league type situation, and then they hope to have him Thursday in Miami for the opener. But I'm just a touch concerned. You know, one of the great things that's helped them is he stayed healthy for the 3 years he's been there, and he's turned into one of the best relief pitchers in the major leagues. But there's never really been a health issue outside of a back issue 2 years ago. But as far as an arm problem, he's never had any arm problems, and this is technically not an arm problem, but it is behind his shoulder. And I don't have a lot of confidence in somebody going into the season only pitched twice all spring, but hopefully I'm wrong and he'll be okay. But I do think there's cause for a little bit of a red flag there, Steve.
So John, who closes then in till he gets back?
Well, Aroldis Chapman would be most likely the former Reds and Yankees closer, and I know that the Pirates surprised a lot of people in the winter when they signed Chapman as a free agent for 1 year and $10.5 million, which is a lot of money by Pirates standards. And, you know, he has over 300 career saves. He's been a six- or seven-time All-Star. And it looks to me, what I saw of him in spring training and, you know, with scouts and other people that saw him other times when I wasn't there, as he still throws close to 100, and he's still an effective pitcher, and they feel the Pirates do, and the scouts I talked to all feel if something would happen to Bednar, that Chapman could still come back, you know, still step into that closer's role and be a very effective pitcher.
Yeah, he can be. He also is the kind of guy that creates managers to find religion. All right, so he does all of that and more. How important, I know the club got off to a good start last year, but how important is it going to be for this club to just get out of the gate, get off to a start, maybe build something early?
Yeah, I think the one thing that they did build some momentum last year, and they had the great start, and then they weren't very good for 2.5 months, and then they finished strong. They went 18-13. They basically knocked the Reds and the Cubs out of pennant contention in the last 2 weeks of the season. So, I mean, you'd like to build on that. I don't think they're going to get out of the gate 22-8 like they did last year. But, you know, I think there's optimism there. There's a feeling that there's finally some light at the end of the tunnel in this long rebuilding that they've been under since Ben Cherington became GM after the 2019 season. And I think they need to play good baseball. I mean, I don't think they need to be 22-8. But the worst thing that would happen when you finally build optimism, both inside your clubhouse, inside your organization, and with the fans here in the Pittsburgh area, is to start off the season like 6-17 or something like that. I think if they can at least keep their heads above water, I think eventually some of the young pitching prospects will come up and stabilize that pitching staff. And I think they have a chance in a division that's really not all that strong to maybe contend if a few things break right. But I do think it, for the morale of everyone, they do need to get off to if not a blazing start, certainly a good start to keep that good feeling going from throughout the end of last season in the winter that things are starting to pick up here.
By the way, what is the thought process in Pittsburgh about the club, about going to the ballpark? I mean, how does the average everyday fan feel about the team?
I think they're encouraged. I think they're a little skeptical because of the owner, Bob Nutting, who historically has just not really tried to win, to be totally honest, and not spent the money necessary. But I do think they look at some of the young players here, and I think the fact that the Pirates brought Andrew McCutchen back last year was definitely a very good PR move. And not only that, but he can still play. He's certainly not an MVP caliber player like he was 10 years ago, but he can still play and contribute. And I think that helped a lot. And I do think there is optimism. There seems to be a lot more interest, you know, take it for what it's worth. But if I'm out, like at the bank or the supermarket or something, you know, I run into people, they'll ask me about the Pirates and seem to want to talk about them. And there for a few years, I mean, nobody gave, could care less. So I do think there is more interest here in Pittsburgh. And now it's up to the Pirates to give the fans reason to sustain that interest.
Hey, John, this is a pleasure. Really appreciate it. Great information as always. And just appreciate the time you gave us.
Oh, my pleasure, Steve. Thanks for having me on anytime.
John Parrotto, who covers the Pittsburgh Pirates, all those great local connections. Great to have John on the show today. Bob Nightingale, by the way, next hour, we'll talk about the start of Major League Baseball, some of his storylines, and also about Shohei Ohtani. And we'll hear from Bob in the next hour. Penn State football next half hour. This half hour been brought to you by NIL Game Changers. We'll come back with more in a moment on News Radio 1070 WKOK.
Want to work for a stable yet growing company? Got it. Want to work for a family-owned business with over 100 years' experience in taking care of customers and employees? Got it. Want to work for a leader in selling more cars and satisfying more customers? Got it. Who has all that? SMC Sunbury Motor Company is looking for technicians across all their departments. Whether you're an entry-level technician, an experienced technician, or someone looking for a career change, Sunbury Motors would love to hear from you. They're looking for technicians for their quick lane, car and light truck service, heavy truck service, body shop, and frame and alignment division. You can apply online at sunburymotors.com, in person at our North 4th Street location, or call Todd at 570-286-7746. Your new career of working on Fords, Kias, Hyundais, Western Star trucks, plus anything that fits in the door
and some things that don't.
Join Sunbury Motors. Your new career is waiting for you.
The best get-togethers start with a trip to the beverage supermarket, Brewers Outlet, Reagan Street, Sunbury. Why? Because Brewers Outlet has not only a great selection of beer, including imports and microbrews, but also a lot more. Brewers Outlet has water, soda, they roast their peanuts every day, and you can't forget about stopping by the pickle bar. Look for great deals on wine coolers and all your favorite snacks. Before you enjoy those special times with family and friends, make your visit first to the beverage supermarket, Brewers Outlet, Reagan Street, Sunbury.
Bringing you an in-depth look at Penn State sports and more. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. The Steve Jones Show is presented by Purdy Insurance, Brewers Outlet, NIL Game Changers, and Sunbury Motor Company. Now from the Sunbury Motor Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Welcome back. This half hour brought to you by Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf, and online at sunburymotors.com. You want the best in new inventory? They have it. Ford, Kia, Hyundai. How about pre-owned inventory? They go over every vehicle, fine-tooth comb, because they want to make sure you have the Sunbury Motors guarantee. It eases the buying experience. And when it comes to taking care of the vehicle, they've got you covered there as well. Whether it's routine or difficult, they have fabulous technicians. All at Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury, Sunbury Motors Kia, Routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf, and online at sunburymotors.com. Bob Nightingale, USA Today in the next half hour. Joined now by Thomas Frank Carr, who's been covering this for a while now, my old friend. Welcome back, my friend. Great to have you with us.
I'm good, Steve. I guess it's settling in that I have been around for a long time. I got so used to being new that, it's been a while. So I appreciate you saying that. And good to hear from you again. It's been too long.
Too long, my friend. It's so good to talk with you again. All right, you've had some limited opportunities, and I mean limited because there's only X amount of periods the media can be out there to watch practice. What have you picked up so far?
So it's been, to your point, it's looking through a keyhole at the things that you're seeing, and I've spent most of my time with the offense, so I'm always curious about the defense, but the things with Penn State's offense that I think are the most interesting that stood out right away. The quarterbacks are going to run this year. I talked to Andy Kotelnicki, I think it was last week, about the idea that they have been putting the quarterbacks through the same ball security drills as the receivers, the tight ends, and the running backs, which last year we saw Penn State, and for years and years we've seen Penn State do ball security drills during practice, but they've been doing something quarterback specific. And Andy Kotelnicki said, we're developing ball carriers, and everyone who carries the football or has the ability to carry the football is going to learn how to take care of it and become a runner. And he said the quarterbacks are included in that. So, you know, looking at his offense over at Kansas, that was a big question mark I had coming into spring, which was how much of this are they going to copy and paste over and how much has to change because, you know, Bo Brevoort can run, Ethan Grunkmeyer can run, and Jackson Smolak, all these quarterbacks can run, but Drew Aller is running the show, and that is not necessarily what we saw from him in the past. But based on what we've seen and, you know, some of the things that I've gotten through inference, the quarterbacks are going to run. So be prepared for that if you're a Penn State fan.
When you watch the Kansas offense, Daniels got hurt last year. He missed. He played three games, missed all the rest. The other quarterback they used can run but is not in the same category as Daniels. So do you take something from watching how he plays?
Yeah, so I think that's a really great point. I liked watching Jason Bean because he was kind of a good balance of the two. He was a passer. He threw the ball well down the field. I thought he was aggressive with the football. So there are elements of the offense that I think absolutely translate. And when you watch those things, the RPOs and the offense and pairing that with the play action and some of the bootlegs and things that are pretty standard in an offense in college, all those, I think, are pretty encouraging when you add in some of these elements in the run game and the things that Kotelnicki does to blend all of it together. I think the RPOs are going to be a big benefit for the quarterback position because last year what I saw on film was Drew had to do a lot of heavy lifting. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of progression reads where it's straight drop back. You've got a first-round draft pick on the left side of your offensive line. You've got a pocket-passing quarterback, so let's lean into those strengths when we have to, knowing that offense still wanted to run the football. This offense, I think they can simplify things, make it a little bit easier for him to get, as James Franklin talked about, some of those rhythm throws earlier in a game. And for people who don't know, RPOs are run-pass option where it's a run play, but the quarterback and some receivers have some pass tendencies or concepts tacked onto a run play. And those are going to be a little more aggressive than what they did previously, where they're going to, from what I've seen, go down the field a little bit more and create some of those one-on-one matchups to help the receivers and to help the quarterback kind of generate offense that isn't so timing, passing game, like NFL-level sort of concept specific.
How about in the running game itself? You talk about the quarterbacks and their ability to run. What does that do, in your opinion, to create space for the running backs in that scheme?
Yeah, this is where I think it's really interesting. The threat of the quarterback running is really important. But the scheme itself and some of the things they do, Andy Kotelnicki, when we talked to him this spring, talked about distortion. He's mentioned that a couple of times in the what he's trying to do to a defense essentially is tear it apart. You know, make zones bigger, move guys around the football field where you want them. And part of that is quasi triple option. You know, there's a lot of packages in this offense that have two running backs. They provide threats in multiple different ways. And then that allows the quarterback to have easier decisions to make in the run game, and then opens up the opportunity to get the running backs in space one-on-one with a defender, getting to the outside more often, I think, in this offense, and then just holistically providing some more options. And I don't want to just compare and contrast last year to what we've seen on film, but it is kind of the point of the talent that they have on the roster. How do you use it more efficiently? And these are some of the ways that I think that are going to be successful for Penn State, with the way that Andy Kotelnicki is able to use similar schemes to what they've used previously. And James Franklin has said, you know, the running game is staying relatively the same. So the core concepts are the same, but how they're using them and how they're implementing them, no two people use a pen the same way, or, you know, whatever tool you want to say, a shovel, a scalpel, whatever it might be. You can use those things differently, and in the hands of somebody different, the same tool can do something different. And I think the run game is a big area of improvement. I think maybe nobody stands to gain more this year than Nick Singleton from those changes, because I do think that, you know, all these layers of the offense are going to create more seams and big play opportunities for him, where previously there was a lot of hard slogging that they had to do on the ground.
What has been your read defensively so far with the change from Manny Diaz, who's now at Duke, to Tom Allen?
Yeah, I have less questions there, Steve, because I think it's a pretty seamless transition. But at the same time, I've seen less of them, and there's been, I think, some more conversation about some of the changes. James Franklin's been pretty clear that they want to go to more of a three-safety look. They want to use the lion position and play, you know, a hybrid defender in the flat. And the funny thing, Steve, is we were talking about this in 2022 with Manny Diaz.
Yeah.
And then suddenly Abdul Carter appeared, and Curtis Jacobs is playing out in the field again. So talent always dictates in these situations, right?
And you brought up Abdul Carter. Having him at a defensive end spot, what do you think the domino is on the defense with him in that spot?
That's been, to me, this is the biggest question about the front seven. Because, you know, we understand that Jalen Reed, it's pretty clear, everyone has said he's going to be a guy that plays that line position. Makes a ton of sense based on his skill set, his instincts, and his ability to play the run and the pass. But when you move Abdul Carter, and this is something we talked about this spring on our show on the YouTube channel, the Blue Illustrated YouTube channel, and James Franklin brought up yesterday, there are consequences to moving Abdul Carter and losing Curtis Jacobs at the same time in the same offseason. You love having Abdul at that defensive end position. He has the ability to drop into coverage. You know that. So you've got the inverse of what he was doing previously, which is he was pass rushing as a linebacker. Now he can drop as a defensive end, but you still have to know what you have at linebacker. And the one thing that we know they have is Kobe King at middle linebacker. And Steve, I'm sure you have a better read on who's playing where at the linebacker position. But Tony Rojas, I think his skill set could make him an outstanding box linebacker. That will position that in most 4-2 defenses is kind of the star of the group, the most athletic, the most explosive, the guy who makes plays. But we've also heard he might play some Sam. You know, that where they line up the linebackers and then developing the depth of the young guys behind known quantities like Dom DeLuca and Kobe King, that's where I have the biggest question. And then how much does Abdul Carter and the defensive ends in general, how much do they factor into playing in coverage and zone dropping and zone blitzing where you're dropping those defensive ends out in coverage? There's a lot of versatility, and that's, Tom Allen talked about that yesterday at practice, is a lot about sub-packages, versatility, and players being able to do more than one thing to provide the defense with that advantage of the unanticipated. And I think he's very good at providing the offense with a lot of unanticipated coverages and things like that. So it'll be interesting to see how he folds in all of those ideas and core beliefs with more talent. Like, how does he use Abdul Carter, and where do these guys play a linebacker?
Yeah, because you and I both know a big part of this is, how can I get my best players on the field? In what combination can I get my best players on the field? That's what part of this is about. bringing in Jalen Kimber and bringing in A.J. Harris to go with Miller and Tracy and Washington and others, what does that combination of now corners, even though Dixon and King are now going to the NFL, what do you think that does to influence a coordinator's thought on how to position players?
Yeah, I think, well, first off, Steve, James Franklin talks about this all the time, and I think you probably have a good view of this, is the competition level at the position. Because we know Zion Tracy and Cam Miller got more opportunities than some of those other young guys last year, but they don't want to have incumbent starters without challenge. So bringing in A.J. Harris and Jalen Kimber, these are guys that have talent and they have experience, so it provides you with depth, and then I think raises the whole level of the group. And this is, to me, this is the thing I'm most interested in, is when Tom Allen talked about it yesterday and talked about the line position, he mentioned Jalen Reed, and there was a conversation about what they liked about with the safeties. And then in the same breath, then started talking about A.J. Harris, Zion Tracy, Cam Miller, guys who can play slot corner. So I'm curious, like, are those the same position? Do they view them as the same position? Because Jalen Reed has a different skill set than a guy like Cam Miller.
Right.
A.J. Harris is a physical guy, but are they all competing for the same position? Or are these more sub-packages and more different personnel groupings they can put on the field? That's a curiosity. Again, I haven't been able to get over the defensive side of the ball to get any of those like little crumbs and clues, but I think that that's something that, just from a logic standpoint, you have to have a cornerback that can play as a slot. And to me, that's what that conversation is about, having those be two different things. But, you know, that's just supposition on my part.
When the blue-white game finally does roll around in a couple of weeks, and that look, and I realize, you know, there'll be a lot of guys playing in this thing that, you know, the fans will not probably see again the rest of the year, or we'll see late in the game sometimes. But is there anything in particular you're looking for, especially early in that thing, just to give you a couple of clues?
Yeah, 100 different things, Steve. This is found out season. Although I always get burned by this. I remember when, again, going back to Manny Diaz, when he came in and wanting to know how he was going to use different personnel, and I was wondering about the safety position. Are they going to play a pure boundary and field and have, you know, kind of a classic for a shortcut here, strong safety, free safety? And then they did that in blue-white games, so I felt fairly confident that that was going to happen. And then halfway through the season, Tig Brown is playing literally everywhere. So I've gotten burned before of taking too much from the blue-white game.
Yeah.
But things like that, you know, like different where they are right now in the spring gives you a good idea of kind of what they're working with and their ideas of what they're going to tool around with later on. So, you know, who's playing in the slot as a receiver? Who's playing outside as a receiver? How much do we see of the offense from what it's actually going to look like with all the shifts and motions and formations? And then defensively, you know, kind of a similar conversation of what young guys are playing, what positions, that linebacker room, and just getting a chance to see some young guys that we don't get to see a whole lot, some of those guys down the depth chart that we're all curious about. And I think especially on the offensive line, there's going to be some interesting things. And there's always interesting things of guys playing different positions and kind of bouncing back and forth between different spots. So there's 100 different things, and there's nothing all at the same time, which is the beauty of the blue-white game. Because if you just want to go and have a hot dog in the sun, Steve, and hang out, like, that's also an acceptable thing to get out of the blue-white game.
Yes, it is. As a matter of fact, I think you just described members of our broadcast booth. All right, so at least a couple of them. Jack and I are kind of like talking about the game. But older players, Devon Ellis, Akeem Beeman, Keandre Lambert-Smith. Let me ask you this. If they were transfer portal guys coming into the program, because I think it's bonuses they all came back, what would you be thinking about each as guys that came into the program, since it's a bonus as sixth-year players or fifth-year players are back?
Yeah, that's a great point. And I think it's one where, especially at that defensive tackle position, it's so hard to find guys that can play. You know, there's lots of guys that have talent, and there's a lot of guys that, you know, provide you with specific things. You know, maybe a guy has good size and can play in certain areas, but you don't know the full extent of what they can do. So with Devon Ellis and the transformation he made last year, that was a guy that I thought by the end of the year, I don't know if he was drafted, but that's a guy that I would take him play in the NFL. The aggression, the size, the physicality that he showed was all impressive. And his production, truthfully, I don't think people gave him enough credit for what he was doing on the defensive, on that interior position. Same thing with Akeem Beamon. And then Keandre Lambert-Smith, I think, provides you with the stability of a guy that can get you those big plays. You know, and I know that that's unpredictable stability, but I think, if you look at it in the sense of a full wide receiver room, you need somebody who's got those skills to generate big plays, and he's a guy that I think has proven since very early on in his career that he's a guy that can get you those big plays. So then you have certain variables you're looking for in that receiver room when you bring in somebody like that.
Very quick, any quick thoughts on the NFL draft with the Penn State players in your mind?
Yeah, the whole Olufashinu slide, I think, is all overblown. You know, this idea that he's going to go into the 20s. The NFL loves pass blockers at left tackle. You know, I understand that the run game is important. I don't want to diminish that. And I also don't think he's this problem as a run blocker that some people might be portraying him as, especially when you compare him to some of these other guys that are impressive run blockers and have those things. But when you look at what Olu can do, there's only so many guys that are 6'6 and move like that. So, you know, unless there's something else, unless there's some off-the-field thing that has nothing to do with his character or his play that is pushing him down the board, I don't buy into that. Also, chop Robinson to the Bills. I'm trying to manifest that one as hard as I can.
I know you're pushing hard on that.
Yes.
To go with the Austin Johnson and Daquan Jones making an all-Penn State front for you.
Yeah, love it. Especially the way Daquan played last year. Yeah, I mean, they needed a guy with size that could also get after the quarterback, and you know, I don't want to call it a late career breakout because I know he's had a good career, but yeah, the defense fit him really well. Buffalo's defense fit him really well. In all seriousness, a guy that I think in the later rounds that I actually wrote about this last week that I have pegged to the Bills is Kalen King.
Yeah.
You know, the conversation about his speed and what sort of system he fits into, if you look at the corners that the Bills have drafted or found and that have been very good players in that system, they all run in the 4.6s and the 4, you know, the 4.5s. And Kalen King ran a 4.62, then a 4.52, and he's a good zone corner that plays, is smart, tacks the run really well. Like, you know, chop Robinson aside, if there's one dude that it would fit with my team, it would absolutely be Kalen King playing corner for the Bills.
Yep. No, I agree with that. Look, it's how you it does get to a point, stopwatch. Look, if I'm a general manager or a scout, I want all the information I can get. In the end, what does the video look like? Can the dude play? All right. So, and this isn't the Olympics. Right? How fast did you run?
He's another guy that. Sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, he's another guy where I think the narrative swung a little too hard the other way, where he was a first round draft pick until he didn't have the same season he had in 2023 that he did in 2022. But that doesn't make him a bad football player because of all of these things. It just recalibrates maybe what he is in the NFL and generally what he is as a football player. And there's a lot of, like, negativity around his draft stock. And I still think, based on what we've seen, Steve, he's a starting corner in the NFL. He's not going to fit every scheme, but I think he's a good football player. And you can't lose sight of that when you have some of these, as you were mentioning, like some of the metrics that might not say he's a top cover corner that can play in any system. Like, there's still value there in a football player that has shown he can cover at the college level.
Always, always a pleasure, my friend. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate that and the information.
Thanks, Steve. Always appreciate coming on.
Thomas Frank Carr on 3.com, Blue White Illustrated. Bob Nightingale, USA Today, in the next hour. Back the next half hour, he'll join us. This half hour has been brought to you by Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf, and online at sunburymotors.com. Bob Nightingale next hour, King in the final half hour. Great to have you with us today on News Radio 1070 WKOK.